American Cassette Ministries welcomes you to an hour of delightful learning with noted author, lecturer, and physician, Dr. Agatha Thrash. Her topic is Fever, Friend or Foe?
In dealing with the human body, we need to understand that there are certain forces that the body initiates in the healing of disease that can help us to heal the disease. Fever is such a force. Fever is not one of those things that we want to squelch as soon as possible because of the fact that it deteriorates the body. It is a fact that when we have a fever, we do put forth a major metabolic effort. But this effort is for the purpose of healing the body. So it will help you in the healing of disease. It will also assist you in the formation of endorphins and enkephalins. These are substances which switch on your internal mechanisms of healing. Now let's go back to the fever. A fever is capable of causing your white blood cells to go up. Now, whether that fever is a natural fever that occurs from a disease or whether it is a fever that you yourself produce with a hot bath or with some other kind of, you can do it with an electric blanket or a hot heat or a hot foot bath or in any other way that you can elevate the body's temperature. This can give you an artificial fever. You just measure this with a thermometer in the mouth and then monitor that at about 102 or 103 or at most about 104. And as the fever goes up, you make a greater immune response. Now, with the immune system being activated and with endorphins in the brain being produced, we have a greater response on the part of the body to heal the body. We have more white blood cells available. We open up blood vessels in all parts of the body. We start producing certain proteins by our immune mechanism. These proteins are such things as interferon. They're also such things as the complement and a number of other blood proteins and tissue proteins that are produced by the fact that we have made a fever. If we take aspirin, aspirin then interferes with the prostaglandin system. The prostaglandin system is a part of the immune system and is a part of a number of other systems of the body. And by having the prostaglandins, we enhance the ability of the body to fight disease. The use of aspirin interferes in that system and makes us less able to fight disease. I believe that if aspirin were presented as a new chemical to the Food and Drugs Administration today, that we would not be able to get it approved because of the fact that it has so many ill effects from it. One of the things is that it interferes with the clotting of blood. Another thing is that it interferes with the production of electrical output from the brain. It also acts as a stomach irritant. Aspirin has many ill effects. We could go on and on talking about the ill effects of aspirin. Do not take aspirin for fevers. Fevers can be adequately treated in another way. And let's talk about that right now. Here is the way to treat a fever in a natural way. Give yourself a hot bath for a fever. In order for you to understand the rationale of a hot bath for a fever, let me tell you how a fever is produced. The first thing that you do when you have a fever is that you constrict your blood vessels, and that makes blood go from the outside of the body to the interior of the body, protecting the body from chilling of the blood. Chilling is not good for the human body. When we chill our extremities, we become more susceptible to viral illnesses. Colds, flu, and don't forget that cancer is a viral illness. So be careful about chilling the body. How can you know if you're chilled? Well, an easy way to do that is something that you can do right now. Put your hand on your forehead. Which is the warmest, your hand or your forehead? Now, most of you will probably say that the forehead is the warmest, that the hand is not so warm as the forehead. Now, some of you will say the hand is warmer than the forehead. Some will say that it is the same, and that's probably what it should be. Hand and the forehead should be about the same. Now, feel back here on the back of the arm. Which is the warmest, the hand or the arm? Well, for most people, it will be the hand. Now, reach down and feel the top of your knee. Which is the warmest? Feel the side of the thigh and determine which is the warmest. The side of the ankle and the top of the foot. Those are all key areas to let you know whether or not you're chilled. Any place that is not as warm as the forehead is chilled. And, of course, your resistance has been reduced to a certain degree by the fact that you are chilled. Back now to the production of a fever. When we are producing a fever, one of the first things that we do is to put the blood internally. That makes the hands chilled. Therefore, to feel of the hands is not a good way to test to see if anyone has a fever by your hand. Feel behind the neck or on the abdomen or under the arms. Those are good places to determine a fever because of the fact that these are protected areas and the blood generally does go to these areas just about as well when you are raising a fever as when you're not. Second thing that you do when you're raising a fever is that your respirations get more slow and shallow. Again, this is a protective mechanism to keep from losing heat from the body. Then the next thing that the body does is to raise chill bumps. And you may have these all over. And the body can raise its temperature a degree and a half in half an hour if all the little muscles that raise our chill bumps all over the body are active at one time. The chill bumps can raise your body temperature a degree and a half in half an hour. We also tighten the muscles. Now, whether or not you actually shiver is immaterial. You still will raise your temperature by the very fact that you tighten the muscles. Now, if it gets enough, we will actually get in a tremor from chilling. If you are shaking, if you do have a chill, then again, you can raise, from this one thing alone, you can raise your body temperature a degree and a half in half an hour. Now, the rationale of the hot bath is this, that when you put a person in a hot bath, immediately they begin to breathe deeper. You will hear it almost immediately when they get in the bath. Even if you go outside and close the bathroom door, you can hear the person say, this is the change in gear. They have then changed from the slow, shallow breathing to a deep, more rapid respiration. They will also relax their muscles. Of course, the chill bumps go down and sweating stops if they have if other conditions are just right. All of these things bring blood to the outside of the body, bring blood more to various organs of the body that can put out antibodies and can assist us with the immune system, such as the spleen and the liver and the lymph nodes and a variety of other organs. Out here on the skin, we have stationed macrophages. These are very important cells in our immune system that help us to fight disease. They are capable of sensing the kind of germs or toxins that we're circulating in the bloodstream. They are also capable of putting into the blood a variety of chemicals, proteins, that can assist us in fighting germs or in neutralizing toxins. So to get the blood to the skin is a very important part. Just to reduce congestion in the interior of the body is also helpful in fighting disease. So we have all of these things in this matter of fighting a fever. So when you give a hot bath as a treatment for a fever, for an infection, You have not just brought the temperature down, but you have also given a basic treatment for the disease from which they are suffering. Now, if you put the person in bed after a hot bath, by the way, you should keep the forehead and head cool anytime a fever gets above 101, whether that is an artificial fever or whether it is a fever that the person raises himself. So cool the forehead as the person is lying in bed, and they will suffer less from the disease that they have. Head and face, and even the neck, if you would like, to make certain that the head is kept as cool as you can have it. Just dip a washcloth in ice water, squeeze it out, and lay that on the forehead if the person is lying in bed. You may sponge the face regularly if the person is, as you are changing the cloth. Now, for some people with a variety of types of fevers, we give only a hot foot bath. That also may cause some elevation in body temperature, but a hot foot bath alone will cause a quickening of the circulation, will bring the circulation to the outside, will change the respiratory rate, but it may not raise the body temperature very much, maybe a degree or a degree and a half, but generally speaking, that will be about all. Now, heat and cold, the extremes, have a rather intense application for blood vessels in making them change their diameter. Now, the way that works is this. An extreme of temperature will cause a blood vessel to constrict, whether it is an extreme hot or an extreme cold. Either one of those causes a constriction. After a little bit, we get a dilatation from either cold or hot. Now, you have gone out of doors, and immediately, in a matter of seconds, the nose blanches. But you'll miss that. You won't notice that the nose gets a little more pale as you immediately go out in a cold air. But after about 20 minutes, you will notice very prominently that the nose has gotten red. Immediately there was constriction of blood vessels, and then there was dilatation. Now, I'd like to tell you a little story. Back in the old days, when we used to do home births, when the time came for the baby to be born, the husband went down to the doctor and notified the doctor that the time had come. And the doctor said something to the husband. What was that? Go home and put the water on to boil. Now, there was a widespread myth that was just to keep the husband busy and out from underfoot. But that is not true. If you go back to the old medical literature, you will find that the doctors did use the hot water. What they did was to give a hot vaginal irrigation for a postpartum hemorrhage. And the record is that it stops postpartum hemorrhage in its tracks. It is a good treatment for this kind of hemorrhage. Now, if you have a hemorrhage from some other place, what do you do? A hot pack can be a very good treatment. When I was in my internship, we had a man brought into the emergency room one night with a very bad internal injury. When we opened up his abdomen, he was in shock when we started, so we started blood in all four extremities. In those days, we pumped it in from jars. So we started this kind of treatment and opened his abdomen. He had an abdomen full of blood, which we already knew. We could actually see the discoloration through his abdominal wall. He was getting worse all the time. So we started working rather furiously. We found several bleeding points and immediately got those under control. But we were not getting the bleeding entirely stopped. And as we were working over in another area, the blood would just be welling up in the abdomen and other places. The anesthesiologist was putting a good bit of pressure on us. He was saying, hurry up and get out. The patient is not in good condition. The blood bank was telling us, we don't have a lot more blood. Please hurry as soon as you can and get the bleeding staunched. We don't know how much longer we can keep on giving you additional blood. So we had all of these pressures on us, and we could see that we were not making much headway. This was at 2 a.m., So we decided we would call the head of the department. We had the fifth-year man and the fourth-year man, and right on down to myself, and I was an intern, first-year person. Our head of the department came in. He said, "Well, have you tried the hot lap packs?" "No, we haven't." Nurse went running out of the room, brought back the hot lap packs. They were at 123 degrees. We had to handle them with tongs. We picked them up and packed them into the abdomen, and in seconds we had a dry field. And then we could see just where our bleeding points were, and we could pick up those bleeding points and tie them off. A very dramatic illustration of the fact that you can stop bleeding with heat as well as with cold. Yes, question here.
Would there be any dangerous anytime if we were to use the heat for hemorrhage?
Question is, can there be a danger in using the heat instead of cold? No, no danger. That is not for the 3 minutes that you're going to be using it, because it's only effective for just 1 to 3 minutes. But if you've got something like a postpartum hemorrhage, that will usually be all that you need. If you have something that is an ooze, again, that may be all that you need. 1 to 3 minutes is all that you need. And the maximum that you should apply it is 6 minutes. Now, to an extremity, there are limits to the temperature elevation that you should make for certain individuals. If a person has insulin-dependent diabetes, do not put the feet in hot water. You may use warm water up to 102, 103 degrees, but do not put their feet in 110, 115 degrees. And 115 degrees, maybe even 114, is about as hot as any one of you would be willing to put an extremity in hot water. Now, what would you use hot water for on an extremity? One would be a sprain. If a person has a sprained ankle, a very good treatment for it is hot water, as hot as they can tolerate it, and cold water, as cold as you can get it. And here's what to do. Put the foot in the sprained ankle up to mid calf or even above. Put that in a deep bucket of hot water. Give the person a stopwatch. At the end of 3 minutes, have him change his foot into a bucket of ice water with ice floating around, or at least as cold as you can get it. After 30 seconds, back into the hot water. So it's hot for 3 minutes, cold for 30 seconds, back and forth. But that's all right. He doesn't have anything to do except manage that stopwatch, because he can't walk on his foot. So just keep that up for as long as he still has pain or still has swelling. Sometimes you can see the swelling actually go down under your eyes as he is going back and forth with that treatment. Often, one treatment only for a minor sprain is all that's needed. For a more serious sprain, you may want to use that for many days. Now, we used to say only use ice in the first 24 hours after a sprain. Ice packs are very good treatments for a sprained ankle, but you may use the heat. And now that you understand the fact that extremes in temperature, both hot and cold, are as effective in stopping hemorrhage as just cold, then you may give the more pleasant treatment for most people, that of the heat treatment. Question. You may do it at least 30 minutes. You should do it at least 30 minutes. You may do it as long as 2 hours. Depends on how comfortable it is to the person, how they're tolerating it, and what else has to be done. Question. Okay, in a sprain, the thing that happens is that you may just have overstretched a ligament, but you may actually rupture a ligament so that you get bleeding, too, and you get a little separation from bones. Thank you. Was there another question?
How come in sports injuries, they will never use heat, and they'll put them in ice, and they'll tape them, and many times the player goes right back out on the court or on the football field?
All right. The question is, why is it that in sports injuries, heat is never used? They always use ice, and often they will tape them and let them go right back out into the game. I would not do that last. I like to treat the human body much more delicately than that. And if I have an injury, I like to put the part at rest. And I think that many of the long-term injuries that we get in sports are because of pushing an injured player. Second thing is that the reason why ice is always used in sports injuries is because of the fact that it is easier to handle ice on in athletics than it is to handle heat, and also it is generally more pleasant to a player than is heat, because they have generated so much heat themselves and do find it better. But and then two, it is just a classic treatment. We have just always used ice. And we have not used heat, but it is as effective in stopping hemorrhage. The theory is, and the use of ice for the first 24 hours, is that since you might expect that there could be some continued hemorrhage, ice would be better at that time. But hemorrhage into tissues has usually stopped in any kind of normal person within a matter of a minute or two, because of the clotting factors that we have. And unless you are very vigorous in your manipulation, or the blood pressure should go very high, you would certainly not dislodge any clot and encourage bleeding from even a warm treatment. Now, a warm treatment or a cool treatment may encourage blood flow, and a prolonged treatment may encourage blood flow, including that of ice. Now, for the use of cold, you might be interested in the fact that there are several places where you would want to try cold first. A bursitis, you should try the application of cold or ice to the area first. Then, after that, try heat if the pain is not relieved by cold. But you're more likely to be successful in treating a bursitis with ice or with cold applications than with hot applications, because of the fact that a bursitis is an inflammation in a bursa, which is a little sac filled with fluid. That sac becomes inflamed because of pressures or irritation as it slips between two muscles. And if we do the same movement over and over, such as in painting, then we may end up with a bursitis because of the fact that the muscle slips past the bursa for enough times to cause an irritation. And you get an inflammation of the bursa, and that gives you that deep, unpleasant, immobilizing pain. If you put heat on the bursa, that may cause it to swell. Well, a swollen, inflamed bursa is much more painful than a more flat, inflamed bursa. So with a cold on it, now this swelling occurs from the fact that any hot body tends to swell just a little bit. So your bursitis, you should try cold first. If the cold does not help, then try heat to a bursitis. I am opposed to using injections of cortisone for bursitis because of the fact that cortisone is a dangerous and toxic drug and increases one's risk for a number of things, such as activation of tuberculosis, increases one's risk of cancer, increases one's likelihood of getting hemorrhage from the stomach, especially if you've had an old peptic ulcer. Another thing that you would use ice for first is that of an acute back strain or an acute back injury. If you have an acute back strain, especially a low back strain, the treatment of choice for the first 72 hours is an ice massage. Take a block of ice the size of a frozen fruit juice concentrate can, the small can. Take a block of ice that size, and that will usually give you enough ice to massage over the area, over about a 6-inch area, for the appropriate length of time, which is 7 to 12 minutes. Now, during the first part, the treatment is unpleasant, but very shortly, the treatment no longer is unpleasant. It becomes very pleasant to the person. block off the area with dry towels to catch the runoff water, and then just massage away, and you will see that it eventually turns beefy red. At that point, you are in the position that you wish to be with the... So keep it up for, at that point, at least 5 more minutes, or a total of 7 to 12 minutes. After 72 hours, then you should use hot alternating with cold. Compresses are easy to apply. Apply a hot towel. It can be wrung out of water, or it can be sprinkled, wrapped in saran wrap, or put in a casserole and put in your microwave, or put in a convection oven and heat it in that way. Then it is light and easier to handle, and tends to not burn so much. If you dip it in water, it tends to burn the patient a little bit more. But you can dip it in water. That's a good way if you don't have any other facility for handling, just sprinkling and a steamed towel, steamed moist towel. Lay that on the back. Let that stay for 3 to 6 minutes. Take that off. Then put a cold compress on for 30 to 60 seconds. Alternate that for at least 4 changes. That's the treatment after 72 hours for an acutely strained back. In our experience, most cases of rather minor injuries to the back where there is an acute sprain, even one treatment may be curative. They may not have any more trouble after that. Another use of cold. Question here beforehand.
The same holds true for just minor lower back pains to come and go.
Yes, minor lower back pains. A cold treatment, an ice treatment, will often give relief in a matter of 10 minutes. All right, another thing that you use ice for, that is a fever blister. Now, those of you who are accustomed to getting fever blisters know when they're coming. Right here at the vermilion border of the lip, you will feel a little painful, burning area. And you know that in a day or so, you're going to have a big, ugly-looking ulcer. Well, let's say you have a wedding that you must go to in a day or so, and you certainly don't want a fever blister. Here is what to do. Take a piece of ice and hold it to the place where you know you're going to get a fever blister. Hold it there for 45 to 90 minutes, and the fever blister will not develop. 45 to 90 minutes. You may hold ice cubes with a washcloth, and it's a very good treatment for it. Now, let's say you neglect the disease and the fever blister does develop. Then, after it has developed and you already have an ulcer there, then the thing to do is to apply hot and cold applications. Hot for 6 minutes, cold for 30 seconds. So it's 6 minutes and 30 seconds. Alternating hot and cold is better than just the heat alone.
Once again, here is Dr. Agatha Thrash.
Yes, question here. All right, the question is, what about shingles or herpes zoster in the back, and what can you do for that? There are several very nice treatments for that, and I'm glad you asked the question. The first thing that you should do, while the blisters are still on, is to apply aloe vera. That may be from the fresh plant itself, or it may be from any kind of commercial preparation. The liquid or the gel may be used, or some ointments that or lotions that contain aloe vera. Those may be applied to the acute phase of the shingles. Then once the blisters have dried up, there are a certain number of people who will get what we call post-herpetic neuralgia. Now, this is a very painful and uncomfortable sensation in the area where the person had the shingles. Light touch sets it off much more than deep touch. Even a change in atmospheric pressure can set off the pain for the person who has a post-herpetic neuralgia. So here is what to do for that kind of affliction. Get a bodysuit and have the person a bodysuit such as leotards or something of that nature that will fit snugly against the skin, which will make it so that the clothing and any other light touch will not be directly on the skin, which irritates the little nerves that are involved in the postherpetic neuralgia. Do you know what the shingles are? Okay, this is a disorder that comes on after chicken pox. A person has chicken pox in youth and later on has the shingles. Yes? Okay, one of the worst cases of shingles around the eyes that I ever saw was in a doctor's wife, and he had tried everything for her before we started using aloe vera. Nothing had been effective at all, and she was having such distress that she was having morbid thoughts, fear of death and expectation of death. And immediately on the application of aloe vera, she began to feel better. Within 24 hours, she was noticeably better. This doctor happened to be an ophthalmologist. And he had two other cases within a year of herpetic ophthalmitis and treated both of those with the aloe vera with very good success from the beginning. But his wife's case was the one that was the instructing case. Yes. No, you may use any kind. Use it fresh from the plant, and it would be nice if every plant, every house had an aloe vera plant growing in it. Nice little plant in the kitchen is good. But you can have a very large plant in your living room. It is decorative, but don't reserve it just for its decorative use. If you have some medicinal use for it, go right ahead and use it because it will reward you by growing some more, either growing some more little plants or growing some more leaves on that plant. So it's a very good thing to have. Also, I believe that every household should have charcoal in it. We'll be talking more about charcoal a little later in the program. I think that may be tomorrow. But I believe that the Lord has given us a number of natural remedies that occur in nature, that if we get these remedies and make ourselves aware of them and knowledgeable about them, that they can be properly used in very simple ways to take care of even serious illnesses. Question back here. No, we do not. No. The question is, do we use the aloe vera for the post-herpetic neuralgia? And no, we use the aloe vera in the acute phase only. We may use a charcoal compress for the person. We may also give charcoal by mouth. We may give heat treatments for the post-herpetic neuralgia and also in the acute phase of shingles so that we can hopefully avoid the postherpetic neuralgia. We do not have enough cases that we can make a statistical analysis of our cases, but it does appear to us in our preliminary studies that we are seeing better results from those cases of shingles which we have treated with fever treatments, raising the mouth temperature up to 102 in the acute phase of the illness. Question back here. All right, question is about poison ivy. There are some very good ways of treating poison ivy, and we mentioned those in our books. I think that we have in our book More Natural Remedies, a section on poison ivy. No, it's in our book Natural Remedies. One of the things that we like to do is to get at the poison ivy right at the time of contact. And if you know you have touched poison ivy, here is what you should do. Everywhere that poison ivy grows, there will also be growing in that area some kind of little succulent plant. It doesn't matter what kind. Just locate a succulent plant growing in the area. Now, that's a plant that has a fleshy leaf that will have some juice in it. Rub the leaf in your hands and bruise it so that the juices will be released. And then wherever you have contacted the poison ivy, rub the leaf on that area. Try to remove the oily substance that you have gotten from the poison ivy. The reason that you get the poison ivy is that there is an oily substance produced by the plant that gets on the skin. So treat it as an oil. So use the leaves to try to remove the oil. Don't spread it all around. Use several leaves and throw the leaf away that you have used. Don't give that to someone else who might also be allergic, but throw that away and get a new leaf. And in this way, try to get rid of the oil. Now, we have not had a case, but again, we have not had so many cases that we can make a bold statement, but we have had several cases of known exposure in known sensitive individuals to poison ivy who have used this little immediate treatment who did not develop a case of poison ivy. Now, number two, the number two phase of treatment is a wash with soapy, warm soapy water. If you know that you have been exposed, or if you are allergic all over, as soon as you get out of the woods where you have had a contact with poison ivy, take a warm, soapy shower, paying close attention to those areas where you have been touched by poison ivy. Third phase is what you do if you get blisters. Then aloe vera is a very good treatment for poison ivy. Now, there are two phases of poison ivy. One is the irritation phase, which is some little blisters that are intensely itchy. The other phase is an allergic reaction. The first is not an allergic reaction. It is an irritation. But it is an irritation to the oil, just as many other plants are irritating when they touch you. And many other substances are irritating when they touch you. Poison ivy is irritating. That first phase of blisters, which are intensely itchy, is the irritated phase. But a number of people will have an allergic reaction with swelling, eczema, eyelids may swell shut, fingers may get so that they can't close them. We had such a patient one time who was discharged from the Army because of an intense allergic reaction to poison ivy. He'd been in the hospital several times. His last treatment was at Martin Army Hospital, where he was treated for 5 weeks. IV fluids, cortisone intravenously, he almost died. Some people occasionally do die from the intense allergic reaction to poison ivy. He was discharged from the Army. His wife was my patient. I'd never seen her husband. One morning early, she called me and said, "My husband is having a very bad reaction with poison ivy." She told me his history. She said, "I wonder if you would see him right away." So I said, "Well, bring him over and we'll see what we can do." She brought him right over. He could not open his eyes. The day before, they had walked along a little country lane that had nothing growing on it, and he had not come within 10 feet of poison ivy. But they recognized it as being his usual poison ivy reaction. We made charcoal compresses for him. I showed her how to do two on his arm. The way to make a charcoal compress is very simple. We're going to show you tomorrow. So we put the compress on his arms, then opened up some bread bags, put the bread bags on his arms as sleeves, and taped them in place with some masking tape or scotch tape. I sent her home with some charcoal and told her to make poultices for his entire body. So she made just a bunch of poultices all over, and I asked her to call me in 6 hours. But I began to think, well, let's see, he did have a very bad reaction. He might have an anaphylactoid reaction this time. Maybe I'd better check on him. In 2 hours, I called to see how he was doing. She said, well, he's doing fine. Breathing was okay. Nothing seemed to be wrong. So we went through the day in that fashion. She changed the compresses every 6 hours. The next day, he called me. He said, do you have any suggestions about changing? So I said, no, how are you doing? He said, better. So I said, well, I'd like to see you. So he said, I'll be right over. This time he drove himself over. He could open his eyes a little bit. He could bend his fingers, not fully closed, but he could bend them enough to drive his car. So to make a long story short, within 5 days, he was totally well of what had the same kind of reaction that before had taken 5 weeks with the use of the charcoal compresses. Question.
What caused charcoal to do what it did.
All right. We're going to discuss this tomorrow. Maybe we could hold charcoal questions until tomorrow. I love talking about charcoal, but maybe we ought to reserve that. Okay, question here. All right, question is, what causes post-herpetic neuralgia to disappear, to be cured? We don't know. You can treat it, though, and tolerate the problem. Question back here. Question is, have we ever treated a patient with an intense allergy to poison ivy by giving them small quantities to eat for detoxification purposes? And no, we have not. But it is sometimes done with some success. Question here.
Should the bee sting handle the same way?
Question is, the bee sting handle the same way? What we do with a bee sting is also a charcoal compress. We had a lady who was stung on her thumb a two-minute walk from my back door one day. This lady, the last time she had been bee stung, had had very intense shortness of breath. She had had headaches and collapse, and it was felt by the physicians who attended her case that if she were ever stung again, it might be a fatal reaction. You may know that more people die of bee stings every year in the United States than die of snake bites. It is quite a serious problem for us. This lady was brought in my back door. She had already broken out in a sweat. She was quite calm, so it was not a nervous reaction. She felt perfectly relaxed and was not frightened at all. But she had a headache. She was feeling weak and faint already. So I knew she was going to have a pretty bad generalized reaction since it came up so quickly and was so intense right away. So I reached up to my charcoal. And by the way, everybody should have all of your home remedies right in a place where you know where they are. Don't have to say, well, let's see, which bathroom did I put these things in? And you have to go all over the house or even go to the neighbors or out into the garage to find where you have your equipment for your home remedies. Those things that you are using for home remedies, keep them all in a box and in a special place so that when you have a need for them, you go right to that place, get your materials out. I reached up, got a charcoal tablet, wet it at the sink, and told her to start rubbing that on her thumb. So she stayed there, moistened the charcoal tablet, rubbed that all over the thumb, all over the hand, while I was making the charcoal compress. So I had the compress made perhaps in a couple of minutes. By the time I had the compress made, she was feeling better. I put the compress on. I said, let's go for the emergency room so that we'll have respiratory assist equipment if we should need it. She said, no, I don't want to go. So I said, I don't recommend this. I think we should go. She said, no, I'm not going to go. So I said, well, I've wanted a patient that I treated with just charcoal alone, but in your case, I wouldn't recommend that we do that since you're so intensely allergic. She refused to go. So we changed her charcoal compress every 10 minutes for half an hour, and then every hour for about 6 hours, as I recall. And after about the sixth time when we put the charcoal compress on, she went her way and then decided that it was too much trouble to keep that compress on. She had a lot of things she wanted to do, so she took the compress off. Within 10 minutes, headache, sweating, feeling of collapse. She was just about to collapse again. Put the compress on quickly. This she went through three times in the next 24 hours before she got the idea that she needed to leave it on for a little longer time. Question? Mud packs, so far as we know, have as much effectiveness as charcoal, but our experience with that has not been as great as with charcoal. Clay has the same kind of pull that charcoal has, the same quality. It is not brought about by the same thing.
Is that all mentioned in your book?
Yes, all of these are in our books.
Baking soda?
Baking soda can be very helpful since for a bee sting, the problem venom is a formic acid venom, And since baking soda is alkaline, it will slightly reduce the acidity, which can reduce the intensity of the reaction.
Is there anything about pulling out the
stinger? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Very, yes, you should pull out the stinger in a special way. Now, the stinger is associated with a little venom sac. So what you want to do is to get some pins or some needle-nosed tweezers and lift it out rather than taking it by the sac. And when a bee stings you, his stinger and the sac all come off at one time. And don't take it by the sac and pull it out, because if you do, you will squeeze in more venom right through the tubes, just like a hypodermic syringe. Question here.
Charcoal internally?
You do use charcoal internally. Oh, yes, we use it all the time.
For any of these type of things that you're using compresses for?
You may use it for all of these also. We gave the lady with the bee stings, we gave her charcoal internally also. By the way, her story is in our book. Question here.
At a health store, I saw a 10-pound bag of charcoal that's supposed to be natural with no preservatives or chemicals. Used for cooking, and I wondered if I could buy it and then crush it up, put it in my own caps, or use it for compost.
Certainly.
In little tiny bottles, a little jar.
Certainly. If you get charcoal that has nothing on it and has been handled in a proper way, that is, hasn't been exposed to small animals and other filth and the like that might cause a problem for the person, you may take any kind of charcoal of that nature, pulverize it in a blender, store it in a dry jar, and it's good. It's good for. It has no expiration date on it. Yes.
I was stung by a bee, and I put a mud pack on.
Yes.
I was telling my physician, and he said, "Great," he said, "you got yourself some free penicillin." Penicillin in
the file? There is a healing agency. Of course, the penicillin is not helpful at all for bee sting, but there is a healing agency in clay. Now, I'm sure that I, just like many of you, I'm sure that many of you, just like I, have a prejudice against clay, and maybe some of these other remedies as well. But I changed my mind one day when I read in the Journal of the American Medical Association that some surgeons had taken a clay extract and had dressed wounds with it. And the those wounds that had been dressed with a clay extract healed much quicker than those without the clay extract, with fewer infections and this kind of thing. Changed my opinion immediately when I saw that one of my colleagues had done something using clay. We tend to be prejudiced people, and I was interested in Dr. Callahan's lecture that he brought up some things that people would ordinarily have some prejudices against, and then he gave the scientific reasons for those, and I was fascinated by his lecture. Questions over here. Question back here.
What about a sting on the tongue?
A sting on the tongue. This does happen often. Yes. It happens more frequently than you would believe. That it does. Bees tend to be drawn to the mouth, and so they can get right there on. If the tongue happens to be in the way, it can get stung. Again, lift the stinger out, and then use a charcoal tablet, and have them just to hold that in the mouth, and it's a very good treatment for any kind of mouth lesions. Okay. Now, the next thing that I would, if there's no other question right now, here's a question.
Back to the shingles in the eyes.
Yes.
I asked you for the aloe vera, and you said that was for the acute stage. Is there anything for when they're in this neuralgia stage?
This lady asked that question, and the answer is no. No. Well, now, I talked about some ways to treat, but to stop it permanently, no. Not once you get past the acute stage. Then the thing to do is the charcoal compress when you have pain on the shingles, and use the thing to keep the light touch from touching it. Right. I wonder if I it may never go away. I wonder if I could have a helper. Would you mind being my helper, the lady here on the front? I would like to show you. Okay. Now, would you just face this way? And I would like to show some massage strokes. Now, probably some of you are professional masseurs or masseuses here, and I would like to dignify massage as a therapeutic agent. It has been in the basement of therapeutics for too long. We need to bring it up on the front, on the first floor of therapeutics, where we can. I see we do have a group of enthusiastic supporters here. Now, massage that you do in the home can be quite beneficial, and you should know what to do when you have a sick person in your home from the standpoint of massage. Most of you will not have some of these fine ladies who are professionals. Here is what you do. Learn some simple massage strokes. One is stroking. Now, you do not have to be a large and powerful person to do an effective massage. With your patient lying in bed, lean your weight into your stroke and come around like this. Get a certain rhythm, and this is the stroking motion that you use. I believe that people who are giving a home massage should not inflict pain. You need to know what you're doing if you're going to inflict pain. Now, another nice stroke is that of a kneading stroke. Pick the skin up or the tissues up like that, and a slight twist and squeeze like that. Can be easily done. You can learn this stroke, get a little rhythm into it, easily learned, and just go over, back and forth. And then when you've done any friction stroke, always do the rubbing stroke as well afterward. Now, there are some percussion strokes. One that you can easily do, if you will just open your fingers up like this and strike yourself on the thigh, this is what you get. Now, no karate chops, just a nice little, with the fingers open. Do you see how you're striking? A lot of tapping can be done to give anesthesia if you wish to carry it on that long. But a nice tapping in this way brings the blood to the tissues and the skin, and follow that stroke also by a stroking in this way. Now, there are many other strokes that are given. We have a section on massage in our book, Home Remedies, and we invite you to take a look at that for its use in the home treatment of disease. By the way, you will notice that I have not taken my hand off the patient during the change of strokes, or if I needed to reach over and get some massage oil, I keep one hand on the patient so that she knows right where I am. One of the objectives is relaxation, and that you cannot have if you're constantly taking the hands off. The patient does not know where you are, then you touch them again and they get a little startle reaction from that kind of thing. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Dr. Agatha Thrash speaking at the 1985 Michigan Organic State Fair Harvest Festival. International copyright 1985 American Cassette Ministries. All rights reserved. This cassette is protected by international copyright and thus protected against copying, duplication, and transcription. Please understand it is illegal to copy this cassette. For additional copies of this cassette, as well as our latest gift catalog, please write to American Cassette Ministries. Our address is Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Our postal zip code is 17108 in the United States of America. Waiting to serve you, this is American Cassette Ministries. We're a nonprofit corporation helping prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ.